First of all, that is some timeless music. First things first. Secondly, I found a book recently from a gentleman chronicling that era in music that we know as Stax Records. And the Stax Records and Soul Explosion. And Robert Gordon is now joining me. His book absolutely is a must if you're a fan of this era of music and of this time period and of this timeless, incredibly great music. Robert Gordon, author of Respect Yourself, Stax Records, and The Soul Explosion. Robert, thank you for joining us on Book Corner. It is great to have you.
Happy to be in the corner with you.
Robert, congratulations on this book. I know you've written several things. You were involved in a television documentary about this era in music, about Stax. What is it about Stax that calls you home?
Well, I mean, personal pride is part of it. I'm born and raised in Memphis, and before I could drive, I started finding my way into this sort of netherworld in Memphis where the blues men and the rock guys would meet. I don't know. Somehow I've managed to stay in that world and make something of a living at it for 30 years, I guess.
Was it something as a kid that just called your name, that type of music, or is it something that you appreciated later on in life?
When I heard Furry Lewis play solo Bottleneck Blues opening up for the Rolling Stones, I no longer had any interest in the Rolling Stones, and I wanted to know more about Furry Lewis. And it sort of has evolved from there. I did end up going to Furry's house. I think that my interest has always been in the world around the music, because Furry's house was so different from my own. I lived in the suburbs, you know, middle class, and Furry had a duplex and didn't have his leg on, and it was all these things that were so different. I began to be very interested in not just the music, but the culture that created the music. And that's kind of been what my books are about.
And what I love about this latest work is you show the clash between what was going on in Memphis at the time and what was going on at Stax, even from the outset of the label, founded by a brother and sister team in the late 50s and then into the turbulent 60s. What went on between the confines of what we know as Soulsville and what was going on outside their doorstep is a complete dichotomy, isn't it?
That was part of what I was really interested in. Culturally, in Memphis at the time, we were a hateful, racist place. Institutionalized racism was the name of the game. And Jim Stewart and Estelle Axton, the white siblings who founded Stax, they just didn't adhere to that. It didn't make sense to them. And so rather than go along with it, they sort of followed their hearts. That meant that in order to make it in the business, they'd moved from the country to the city. They got an abandoned theater in a neighborhood that was going from slightly integrated, more white, to more black. And that meant their clientele were buying black records. Estelle started stocking black records, and they just embraced the people who came in the door. People who shopped in the record store in the front and people who wanted to record in the back. That kind of open-hearted attitude, which really does define Stax and which I think you can hear in the grooves, that's what set it apart from the rest of the city. So it very quietly became an example that we would later look back on and go, oh, that's what integration is like. That's what getting along is like. That's what you can accomplish with respect.
You paint the picture. And you took me through this, and I've got to say, I've always been a fan of their music. I've always been an enthusiast. I'm a vinyl freak, and here I've got several of the records on vinyl. I love the sound. I love what they did. I had no idea that all this was going on behind the scenes. As you start to tell this story, let's go to the first third, because I'm going to break this into thirds today, sort of as your book did. The first third is this is a mom-and-pop deal. They're getting this thing off the ground. And one of the tenets by which they do this is they have an open-door policy that you already referenced. Who could have ever thought that they would have that kind of talent just in their midst that would just come in from the neighborhood. Elaborate if you can.
Well, it was accidental. Most everything about Stax lacked a plan, certainly in the first half of its existence. And these people, through being respectful, were just, they were lucky and they were smart enough to follow their luck. They set up a record shop where the candy counter had been in the movie theater, and they set up a recording studio in the back of the theater. In a way, they hadn't intended for it to be, but the record shop up front became like the talent attractor. So word got around that there was a recording studio here. Rufus Thomas, who was an influential disc jockey in town and also a great artist, had been on Meteor Records and Sun Records and a few other labels, comes in and says, show me what you got in the back. They're happy to see a disc jockey in there because they know that that can lead to sales. And in short order, he and his daughter, Carla, cut a record that starts to sell and gets the attention of Atlantic Records. And Jim and Estelle say, okay, Atlantic, we like Atlantic. That's good. Atlantic wants to distribute this. Great. And the sort of the hits begin to roll from there.
Yeah, and so that early period's a real time of innocence. You've got kids that are in high school. You've got Booker T, who's from the neighborhood. You've got this band, the MGs, who were high school kids. They were classmates of one of the co-owners of the studio, yes?
Yes. The initial band is the Marquees, who are white guys who want to sound black, who love R&B and want to play like that. They're starting to hang out on Beale Street and in West Memphis. And some of those guys are more talented than the others. And eventually, a couple of them morph with a couple young professional black musicians and create an integrated house band in Memphis in 1960, 61. That's Booker T and the MGs. Booker T, he'd been in the record store a number of times before he ever made it into the recording studio. He said, I knew they were recording back there, but I didn't know how to get there. And one day, Rufus Thomas, for the first big session over there, the Rufus and Carlos session, they needed a baritone sax. They knew Booker could play anything, so David Porter, who was a vocalist with some bands in town, he was skipping school to make the session, and he ran and got Booker out of school and said, come on, man, we need you on a session.
It's incredible. And from the neighborhood comes people like, as you mentioned, David Porter. David Porter and Isaac Hayes wrote some of the most timeless, I'm talking about songs that will be heard 100 years from now, music.
I mean, look, some of them have already been going for
50 years,
and they're undiminished. They light up a room. They're the ones who wrote Soul Man and Hold On, I'm Coming and B-A-B-Y Baby, Carla Thomas's B-A-B-Y Baby, and their catalog is just incredible. And those songs have lasted. Again, it's because I think you can hear that excitement of working together, of cooperation, of respect, of joyfulness. You can hear all that in the grooves.
Isaac Hayes comes to them how?
Booker is leading this band. He's in high school, and his family was all about education. So he announces, while Green Onions is on the charts, he says, hey, I'm leaving in the fall for college. And they're like, what? What? You got a chart record, man. You know, we need you on this session. Don't go to college. But he's determined, and he goes to college. And there's another player, a horn player around Stax named Floyd Newman. Floyd says, hey, come here, Isaac. Part of the reason was that Isaac could also play saxophone. Floyd wanted to get Isaac off the sax and onto the keyboards so that Floyd wouldn't lose his gig at the studio. Everybody's doing these shortcuts with these, and the result is we get a team like Isaac Hayes and David Porter who write all these songs.
As you said before, it's completely accidental.
Some would say that the people at Stax were the luckiest people in show business, but I think that luck, while certainly a factor, was not solely responsible. You also have people who know how to respond to a given situation. And people more dominant, people less secure, people for a whole variety of reasons might not have taken this same luck and turned it into what it became. But I think that Jim Stewart, who was the key producer at Stax, he was amenable to letting people show their colors. You know, if you are really good, he didn't want to get in your way. He would guide you a little bit, but he wasn't, you know, super hands-on. He just said, okay, this is not good enough to record, to put out, go do it again. Duck Dunn, the bass player in Booker T and the MGs, said he'd look in that control room and he would say, don't you hear what we're doing out here? It's great. But he had good ears.
And so now we get to the period where we get into the sweet spot. We're in the early, mid-60s. Let's get to late. We're around 65, 66, somewhere in that time period. You've got all these great acts. Sam and Dave are flying. You've got chart-making songs. You've got the deal with Atlantic Records, what they thought was a distribution deal. More on that here in a little bit. And then you have this incredible, once-in-a-lifetime talent who took to the music world like a comet. Tell me about the late great, and we still to this day, when we hear his music, we know how incredibly great. I have his box set in the other room.
Yeah.
But Otis Redding's one of a kind.
A great example of the open door. Someone in the business wanted this guy in Georgia named Johnny Jenkins to come record with the MGs. So they send him up. The MGs are outside to greet him on an August afternoon when they arrive. Johnny Jenkins gets out of the passenger side, apparently doesn't have a driver's license. So the guy who's driven him up gets out, starts to unload the gear. He's the roadie. He's unloading food, gear, clothes. They go inside to record with Johnny Jenkins, and nothing's clicking. I think because Johnny Jenkins was a stage talent. He was real dramatic on stage. He could put the guitar over his head and play and behind his back. But he couldn't jive. I don't think he could slow down enough to get in sync with the MGs. And the session's over. And actually, people are packing up for their evening gigs to go play in clubs. And Al Jackson, the drummer, says to Steve Cropper, man, would you listen to this driver over here? He's been bugging me all day. And Steve's like, okay, you know. The guy says, hit me with some church chords, triplets. And Steve, who's not much of a keyboard player, sits on the keys and starts to bang out something simple. Otis starts to sing, and Steve's out in the parking lot going, come on back in, come on back in, you know. And it was like in the waning seconds of the session, they cut These Arms of Mine, which becomes Otis Redding's first hit single. It's not immediately a hit. It's got a slow build, sort of like the song itself. It took about 6 months to become a hit, but it begins his career. And he becomes the beacon for Stax. His success will elevate all of Stax.
Robert Gordon is the guest. Respect Yourself, Stax Records, and The Soul Explosion, which is available on Bloomsbury. And also you can check out Robert Gordon's website, which is therobertgordon.com. I encourage you to do that as we talk with him on Book Corner. So now we make our way, Robert, where they're flying high. Everything's going great. Sam and Dave are making great records. And we get to that year, and boy, what a dark year it was. 1967. First of all, the loss of Otis Redding and the way you set it up, it breaks your heart even to read about it now.
It does. I will say that I always well up with tears when I read that section. Even now, as many times as I've read it, as many times as I wrote it, I have to hew my words. You know, a lot of people are really good on the first draft. I've got to go through quite a number of drafts to get it right. But there's this group, these kids in Memphis who begin to hang out at Stax. They become a band, the Barquets, and the MGs have trained them, and Otis picks them up and makes them his band. And they're all out on a gig. Otis is at the studio for what he doesn't know is going to be his final session. He's had voice surgery. He's sounding great. He's feeling great. He's venturing into this new style that Dock of the Bay is an example of, and he goes out for a weekend of dates. He plays Nashville, he plays Cleveland, and then he's on his way to his final gig in Madison, Wisconsin, and the plane goes down in the lake, killing everyone on board except for the trumpet player Ben Colley, who, in one of those inexplicable ironies, is the only one on board who can't swim. Ben's memories of that are just bone-chilling.
Oh, I mean, the depiction of how he sees these guys and then he doesn't see them. I mean, just the way you were able to relay that and the visual that I got from it. And we were talking before we came on, excellent writers have an ability to put you there, which is what you did in that chapter.
Yeah,
and then,
you're
very welcome. But the chapter then follows up with what I would consider just a kick to the gut.
Yeah.
So they lose him as a label, and then all of a sudden some of their drawing power, their buying power, seems to wane. Then you have Martin Luther King in this same, in all in this one fell swoop. He gets assassinated down in Memphis.
And which is at a place, the hotel where it happens is where
they used
to, one of the few places that over the years the people from Stax have been able to repair to for kicks.
Yeah.
They can swim in the pool integrated. They can eat in the coffee shop together integrated. So it's like their home away from home,
it's
the Lorraine Motel where Dr. King's assassinated.
So the Lorraine Motel's a refuge to him, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Like Booker said, it couldn't have happened nearer to us unless it happened at Stax.
Mm. And so we go back, and now we're in this period of uncertainty. And what does Atlantic do? You know, I've always had this feeling toward Atlantic Records that they were the little guys, and they got up, and Ahmet Ertgin and those, and his brother, and Wexler, and those guys were all about music. Boy, they were cutthroat business people. What they did to this poor family, it had me really. I was pissed off when I read that again 50 years later.
Good. They have made a deal. The Atlantic relationship begins in 1960 with Rufus and Carla and a handshake. And I think Atlantic puts up $1,000 or $5,000 for the record. And then over time, by 1965, when Atlantic is distributing everything, someone at Atlantic says, hey, you know, we don't really have a deal with them. It's all this handshake, which for Jim Stewart was all it ever needed to be. So Jerry Wexler from Atlantic comes down with a contract that Jim Stewart doesn't read. Now, that's Jim Stewart's fault. We all are trained to read anything before you sign it. And Jim, who had been in business school, should have known that, but he didn't. And it was a 13-page contract, and there in the middle of it, about 6.5 pages in there, you might say it was buried, was a clause that said, anything that Atlantic puts out and distributes for Stax will become Atlantic's product. So Jim says to Jerry, this just continues our deal, right? Jerry says, yes. Jim signs it. And there was a key man clause in there so that if Wexler was leaving, Stax would have the option to break the deal and follow Wexler. And that was triggered because Atlantic was selling itself to another company. So now they've lost Otis Redding in December. Dr. King's been assassinated in April. And in May, they find out that their deal with Atlantic is over and they don't own their catalog, that everything they've put out is owned by Atlantic. They'll continue to get a royalty on it, but that's getting crumbs compared to the whole meal that Atlantic's going to have for basically not having done anything but distribute. They never bought in.
They stole the master tapes. They stole and they steal the masters of some of the great iconic songs of all time. Just if you can, enumerate some of the hit records that are a part of this group of records stolen by Atlantic.
Well, Soul Man and Hold On, I'm Coming. Rufus Thomas's Walking the Dog that was quickly covered by the Rolling Stones. Green Onions, Hip Hugger. It's a list, lots of good stuff. Some early Staple Singer stuff, William Bell's catalog, the early half of William Bell's catalog. Lots of beautiful songs that Stax put their heart into got taken by Atlantic.
Completely devastating. So now we're at a point where the King assassination has happened.
And I'm sorry, I've got to interrupt
you
there. At the King assassination, one of the things I'm proud of in the book is that Dr. King is in Memphis for the sanitation worker strike. And I'm from Memphis. I know a lot about the history, and it was while working on this book that I realized there must be roots to this sanitation worker strike that I don't know about. And I went back to old newspapers and put together a narrative about the sanitation workers conflict that had begun in the late 1950s. And one of the things that tipped me off was that Booker, as a kid growing up, his father had trained him to shake hands with the sanitation workers. It suddenly dawned on me there's more to this than just what happens in 1968. So I was able to create a parallel of the hard evidence of what institutionalized racism brings by using the sanitation workers conflict through the first half of the book, and then busing, really, in the second half of the book, these two racially charged issues that help convey the day-to-day circumstances in the city.
I'm glad you added that, because the truth is, that's what I love about this work, is that it's a period piece, and the turbulence of the 60s is such a time that people of my age, I'm 47, I have trouble understanding that. I was born in 1966. People younger than me, it's like Greek to them, but the truth is, it wasn't that long ago, and we're going to get to a point in this book where I get mad at Memphis, but for now, right now, I'm really angry with Atlantic Records. I understand the institutional racism, and the thought of that these days does anger me, but I'm going to move along here to the period where Al Bell really starts to assert himself, because now Stax is to a point where they've got nothing. What they have, their recordings have been stolen from them. You've got their biggest star, their brightest light, is dead. Sam and Dave have been taken back by Atlantic after Stax, through the whole specter of what they do, turned those two guys from Miami into stars. And now Atlantic takes them, and they're going to reap the benefits from that. And so
Well, actually, they don't. They kill them because they don't know how to produce them. So.
But they were going to try to, is the point.
They certainly tried.
Yeah. This is the point where we get to the soul explosion. Share with me what the soul explosion is.
So Al Bell, who had been a disc jockey in Memphis and helped Stax break records, break them open, he is hired back in 1965 to help promote the label. And at this break in 68, he looks around and says, wait a minute, we're all hurting here. On all these different levels, but look, we may not have a catalog, but we have artists, we have a recording studio, we know how to make records, we can make a distribution deal, and let's create an instant catalog. He calls it the Soul Explosion. He's aiming for like 30 albums and 30 singles at once, and he's going to make it a huge event. Al is a visionary in a way, and he's the one who gives Stax its sense of direction from 1968 on. And the Soul Explosion is a big success. Interestingly, all the effort they put into the things they think are going to be huge don't become huge, and one of the kind of filler records becomes the huge one. Again, you know, happy accidents. They had a songwriter named Isaac Hayes who said, hey, can I put out a record? And Al Bell said, carte blanche, Isaac. Isaac told me, he said, I don't have to do anything here, man. All these other records are going to carry it. I can do whatever I want. And so instead of an album with 10 songs, his has 4. Instead of the songs running 2.5 or 3 minutes, the shortest one is 5 minutes, the longest one is like 18 minutes, you know. So he does his own thing. It's an era of the natural. Isaac shaves his head. Isaac goes completely against the grain, absolutely unusual, and becomes the huge star that will really carry the label for the next half of its life.
And the next half of its life, I love that early 70s. It's hard to describe what it is. It's like, a lot of it's like psychedelic black music. Like you were talking about that dramatic stuff. Some of it was recorded up in Detroit. And again, they bring it to the label. They're able through their distribution channels. And what about the distribution channel? I love the way you depict Johnny Baylor in this thing. That guy's completely out of control. But you can't help but love him because they're underdogs at this point. I mean, they've got to pull out all the stops, right?
Yeah, I don't know about the can't help but love him part, but yeah, it's a change in how things are done in the business. What's happening is the record business is full of payola. It always has been. It is now. It's just called different things. It's legislated or regulated different ways. But Johnny Baylor was Stax's muscle man, the guy who made sure that Stax would get paid for their work. Well, he began by making sure Isaac Hayes would get paid for his gigs, and then after that, it was about making sure the distributors would pay.
And so eventually they fall by the wayside in the mid-70s after a tremendously successful period. Again, they were left for dead. Al Bell's able to resurrect them and to get them back to a point where they are a power player once again in the music scene. And then it just sort of all unravels. And it's such a tragedy when it does, because the original owner of the label, who had been bought out, put his money back into it because he so wanted to see it. He wanted to see it make it, right?
He was attached to his baby, you know. He had no obligation. He had sold out when the company was at its peak, maybe a little prior to its peak. He could look around and say, I didn't tell him it was silk and it was a pig's ear. The company was a success. He bore no responsibility for the problems that it had. And when he sold out, he got the top dollar he'd wanted. He really got what he wanted. And then when the combination of things, some mismanagement, their bank that they were dealing with had an embezzler and also its own mismanagement, it was actually costing the bank money to make loans. And then a distribution deal, once again, that went south. This time, Clive Davis gets fired at Columbia, and he and Al had made a deal that was just being executed. Because it was unusual and because it was particular to Clive and Al, with Clive gone, Columbia tried to make it fit into their normal plan. The relationship with Stax never developed, and there seems good evidence that Columbia actually tried to break their backs by warehousing their product. In other words, Stax paid to have its own records pressed and delivered to Columbia, and then Columbia just said, thank you, and they put him over in the dark part of the warehouse and accumulated more and more there. So Stax was paying money but not receiving money.
Set him up. They set him up for failure and basically squeezed life at him. So now I'm angry with somebody else in your book. But let me get to somebody who really, really, really urinates me off here at the end of the book. I can't believe for the life of me that that city would allow, and I go to your epilogue at the end here, you're entitled I'll Take You There, where you show the 1991 dedication and Ben Cawley, the surviving member of the Barcays, the original crash with Otis Redding, is sitting there playing his trumpet next to a dedication of a marker. And there's a marker there because the original building where all this happened has been torn down. How could that city let that happen to that building? That's incredible to me.
Well, I certainly can't give a defense for it. My explanation would be it's just an example of the racism that is at the core of this city. The bank wound up owning that land. They sold it to a church for a dollar. The church didn't do anything with it. And in the end, that building got so deteriorated that it had to be torn down. Interesting little side note here for those of you familiar with the World Wide Web. When it was being torn down, there was no back on the building, no ceiling. Much of the ceiling was gone. I went by there to sort of bid the building farewell. Saw that I could get in the back of it because there was no back wall. And I started opening doors, and I found a closet that had two boxes of tapes in it, wet, muddy, salamander-covered tapes. And over time, I dried them off and got them transferred, and I put the best of them in a little collection called The Ghost of Stax Past that you can hear on my website at therobertgordon.com.
That is phenomenal.
It's pretty cool because these are old tapes, and they're really intimate. You know, I think that what it was like the people who came in to audition on Saturday morning, that's where they throw the tapes in this closet. Some really old marquees, sort of rehearsal tapes, Booker T rehearsing, a couple song demos are in there. Just real oddball, bare-bones stuff. It kind of gives you an inside feeling for Stax.
Tell you something really interesting that you'll appreciate. A friend of mine named Earl Keister lived down there for a job. He's back in East Tennessee now, but he said, oh man, I love Stax. You know, Soulsville's so great. And I look at him and I go, hey, that's the original place, but that's not the original building. He looks at me and says, well, come on. And I say, well, it's incredible that they would tear that building down. Again, I go back to this. I know they've rebuilt and we're going to give this the due that it's deserving. It's just so too little too late, isn't it, that they rebuilt it? Even though with what they have there now, there's a lot of great things happening that your book shined a light on. I'm glad to see they're letting the spirit live on.
Exactly. I think that having done the tragic deed, after we get past that, that happened. So now, what can they do? They found the original plans. The building is rebuilt to spec of the original building. On the outside, it looks exactly the same. Inside is a museum that chronicles the achievements of Stax And then the whole museum is really just the beacon for the effort that is to educate kids and to rebuild the community. So it's a sort of three-pronged plan, and the education part is the highlight. It started with an after-school program. After a couple years of that, they realized the need, and they formed a charter school. And the charter school began with one sixth-grade class, and now it's got 6th through 12th grades. Its third graduating class was last spring. Third class with 100% college acceptance. One girl got a full ride to an Ivy League school, and several kids have gone to the Berklee School of Music, among other music schools. So they combine music with education, and they are giving kids an opportunity in the same way that Stax itself used to give kids an opportunity.
Robert Gordon, your book moved me. I've got to say that. It's called Respect Yourself. And here's the truth about this book. We barely scratched the surface. There are so many terrific stories in here. So many great memories and recollections, and it'll bring you back to that time period. Respect Yourself, Stax Records, and The Soul Explosion. It is from Bloomsbury Books, Robert Gordon. Remember to check out his website, therobertgordon.com. And Robert, when we do these features, I like to give folks like you the opportunity to have the final word. If you want to reiterate a point or introduce something into our conversation, please feel free as I tell you the floor is yours.
I think, you know, the great lesson here is if society is doing wrong, even though everyone else is doing it, you don't need to join in. You know, Jim Stewart and Estelle Axton said, we will not be bigots. We will not segregate at our place of business. And the achievement they created by opening those doors, the doors of their hearts and of their enterprise, have changed all of our lives because we all have danced to that music. Follow your heart.
Thank you so much. It was so great talking with you, and congratulations on your book and all your success.
Thank you, Tony.
And thank you for giving me a few minutes here.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Robert Gordon, Respect Yourself, Stax Records and The Soul Explosion. Check it out from Bloomsbury as this concludes another Book Corner. Thank you for listening.